The choice is in your hands.
Britain Designs.
Most of the countries in the world are outside the European Union, and they're doing very nicely, thank you.
Britain Designs.
I believe that Britain will be safer, stronger, and better off in a reformed European Union.
You're listening to Britain Decides, the EU referendum debate on TRE.
It's the most profound political decision of my lifetime.
Britain Decides.
With Stephen Ritson.
It's time to speak up.
Good afternoon and welcome to the seventh of our special programmes dedicated to the British referendum on membership of the European Union, which is, of course, a reminder for you to take place on the 23rd of June. Just looking at the latest things, the bookies for you, things have changed slightly in favour of leave, has to be said. This time last week, it was, according to, this is an average of all of the bookmakers in the UK. Last week, it was, at its highest point, it was an implied probability of 85.47% that the UK would remain in the European Union. And now that has gone to 75.19. This is where people are putting their money, remember. This isn't an opinion poll, if you like. So it's 3-1 odds on to stay and leave 13-5. That's the latest there. On today's programme, among other things, we'll be looking at the consequences for sterling and the euro if we stay or leave. And for many of you who receive perhaps your pensions or other source of funds in pounds and then spend them in euros, that might have an implication for you. Will it dramatically change? Should the pound drop in value? Then it means, of course, you have less to spend in euros. We'll be looking at the issue of immigration as well. We've often heard of versions such as the Norwegian model, the Swiss model. The Norwegian model is in the European Economic Area, so that's similar to Liechtenstein, tiny little principality, of course, Iceland. And then there's the Swiss model, which is slightly separate. One of the things we hear constantly is that Norway has to accept the free movement of people. That's the amount of money that it pays to the European Union, but in order to have this favourable trade relationship with the European Union, Norway has to allow the free movement of people. But what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that you or I could just go and live in Norway and perhaps shack up and claim benefits and whatnot, or get a job? Do we need any special conditions or skills? And so that's one of the things I'm going to be asking Raoul Rappel from. He's from the Open Europe, which is a think tank, widely respected think tank. They've remained neutral all the way throughout, so they haven't spoken out in favour of remaining in the European Union or leaving all throughout this referendum campaign. Raoul is in Brussels, of course, one of the hearts, the beating hearts of the European Union. So he's the co-director of Open Europe. I'll be putting that question, other questions to him. We might even get on to security. You may remember the end of last week, Vladimir Putin said that Poland and Romania are in Russia's crosshairs now. He said that because there's a missile defense shield ostensibly aimed at Iran. One of them is in Poland, quite near the Russian border. Russia says that this, if it's aimed at Iran, why is it somewhere else? And that Russia will have to respond in kind. Now, this is a NATO issue, but of course, it also affects issues to the European Union. This conversation we heard last week that there were preliminary plans have been drawn up by Germany and France for the possibility of some sort of European armed force, perhaps not an entire replacement for national armies and air forces and navies, but perhaps in conjunction with that. So the security issue, also in the light of the immigrant vessel with just a few people on board, seems that they're mostly Albanians with a couple of Brits on board, a dinghy that had to be rescued off the coast of Kent in the south of England, and the security-related matters to do with that. And also, whatever else, of course, that you would like to talk about in today's programme, remember, as always, you can post on our forum at talkradioeurope.com. You can call on 952-78-4000. 952-78-4000 is the number. You can call us right now if you've got a question or a point you'd like to make. I'd like to also find out from Raoul Rappel from Open Europe, while we've got the chance, a question that a few of you have asked me to ask, if you like, is what trade barriers might look like. We hear from the Leave side that countries around the world, most countries in the world are not members of the European Union and trade perfectly fine, thank you very much. This is under World Trade Organization rules, WTO rules. So that would be, for example, our relationship at the moment with the United States, because we don't have TTIP in place. Our relationship with China, the rest of the world, apart from the special relationship we have, as I say, with the European Economic Area and with Switzerland, which is a different kettle of fish. There's lots of little bilateral treaties that we have with Switzerland. What do those trade barriers look like if we were suddenly the UK to become the same as China, to all intents and purposes, or Morocco, other country, then what's the cost of that? Is it worth it? Is it expensive for the imports and exports? We hear some of you, not just John from Los Boliches, but others saying, clearly it's not in the European Union's interest to impose high trade barriers, because then if we did the same thing, they wouldn't be able to sell us all those nice German cars. And so they will lobby their own politicians to keep those trade barriers low. That may be the case. We'll try and find out about that in today's program. Now, let me just see. There's one. Here's one. We'll try and find out. Maybe Rob can find out for us. Rob Humphries is producing in Marbella, by the way. I'm on the Costa Blanca speaking to you live. Bob has emailed in. He says, do you remember mentioned last week about the envelope? If people want to vote by post, the postal vote, you receive an envelope. And some people are saying, it's not clear. It says postage will be paid by addressee. In other words, you don't have to put a stamp on it. And I suggest, and if you didn't do that in Spain, then it wouldn't be posted. The cost of that, I think, seems, one of you told me, is around €1.50, something like that, to put the stamp on it. I suggested, hopefully not in a patronizing way, but suggested that it might be obvious that if it's paid by the UK authorities, if you're in the UK, if you're outside Britain and you decide to put it in a postbox in the United States or in Spain, then it would seem pretty logical that you'd have to put a stamp on it. However, Bob says, I'm puzzled because some of your callers say that you have to put a stamp on postal voting letters. Bob, he's somewhere in Spain, I imagine, says, I've received my voting form today and on the envelope it says, no stamp required. And then it says it in French. Réponse, well, responsé, says, according to the spelling here, pays, Grande-Bretagne. So, in other words, Great Britain will pay for it. Interesting. If any of you have got any thoughts on that, then do give me a call.
Actually, Stephen, we had a forum post from Peter Stubbs on the 28th of May. He's in Mazaron, actually highlighting the same issue, saying that the voting forms have arrived with prepaid return envelopes, which unfortunately are not valid in Spain. Not valid in Spain. His local Correos, he said, has a bin full of these envelopes, which apparently were going to be scrapped. Please inform people that they need to buy a stamp costing €1.55 or their vote basically isn't going to get there, which I guess that's a concern, isn't it? If some of them aren't going to arrive, that's not ideal, is it?
No, clearly. So to all our listeners and anybody you know who, for some bizarre reason, doesn't listen to Talk Radio Europe as much as they might, then do tell all your friends, remember to put the stamp on that. And I would imagine, as I say, that Rob, would apply not just for this, but for anything. If you've got the equivalent in Spain or you're in the UK, you think about the logic of it. You put it in a Royal Mail postbox. Do they even exist still? I think they do, don't they? You put it in a Royal Mail postbox. Why would the Royal Mail send it to Spain when they have had no part in deciding on whether the postage is free or not?
Yes, I was going to make a flippant remark about perhaps that's an argument for staying in the EU, so all the postmen carry on cooperating, but that opinion might be taken down and used against me as bias, claiming that I'm a Remain supporter, mightn't it? So,
yeah,
I won't.
In fact, I don't think it would make a fine bit of difference. It's about the, in many cases, the privatised companies that are running the mail. Kate says, if I had the luck to have the vote, I'd pay. She says, I bloody well pay the postage, to be sure. Yes, writing in capitals there, which, in case you don't know, Kate is shouting on the internet. But yes, I take your point now. One of the latest developments in the EU referendum debate that's going on, and this is the last 24 hours or so, is the fact that the Vote Leave side, they say that should we go, we'll have, we being the UK, we can have an Australian system for immigrants. This is a points-based system. They say they say that's a good idea. Remain campaigners say that that idea would wreck the economy. Vote Leave thinks that the scheme, like the one in Australia, is the right way to bring down the number of people going to the UK by judging skills and qualifications. Gisela Stewart is a Labour MP. She's in a minority among her party because she's an out campaigner, and she says current immigration policy isn't working.
At the moment, we are part of the European Union, and there is a population of about 500 million who have the right to be here. And what the point system will do is allow us to take control.
Okay. Now, that topic is being credited with providing that boost in the polls for those who want to leave the European Union. The latest, by the way, just in for me now from the bookies, is that Leave is now 11-4, so you know. And they're staying on that issue today, the Leave campaign. They want this point-based system. Remain campaigners think it's a bad idea. Damien Lyons-Lowe is from the polling firm Servation. He says immigration is now a big issue.
Started with a group of 10,000 voters, and then we broke them down to the swayable voters. And we asked them to rank the top messages that might sway their vote. For Leave, 55% of people chose an immigration-related message.
Okay. Meanwhile, there's a report from the TUC, the Trade Union Congress. It claims that workers could lose nearly £40 a week if the UK leaves. Francis O'Grady is from the union group and says the rights of lower earners could be particularly at risk.
Well, this report today shows that we only get one choice, in or out, and our analysis shows that workers would be worse off if we came out in terms of their pay, their jobs and their rights.
Okay, that's Francis O'Grady from the TUC. Now let's have a look at what the Australian system is. It's been suggested by UKIP in the past and now by Brexit campaigners. So Boris Johnson, Michael Gove and others, Priti Patel are among those that say that we could look at the Australian model. Skilled migrants made up about 68% of Australia's 2014-15 migration programme. So this is the latest figures we have for Australia. By the way, per capita, it's a smaller population, but per capita, Australia has considerably more immigrants than the United Kingdom. It's an interesting point, even though they have this lauded point system for the Leave people. So skilled migrants made up about 68% of the 190,000 places. This is in the last year. The migration program controls the variety and number of workers moving to Australia. And according to the Department of Immigration there, it's specifically designed to target migrants who have skills or outstanding abilities that will contribute to the Australian economy and to fill labour shortages. Over the past 15 years or so, Australia's non-humanitarian migration policy, because we're talking about economic migrants here, right? When it comes to refugees, asylum seekers, or humanitarian issues, that's a part. They're very strict on that, of course, but you have to prove that you qualify for such status. But we're talking about the economic migrants here. And a background note by the Australian Parliamentary Library notes that a change in policy in the late 1990s resulted in a shift in the balance of permanent migrants from a majority coming through the family stream, that is, reuniting family members, people who are already in Australia and other members of their family went to join them. Now it's shifted to majority skilled migrants. So to mention the Australia thing, because this is the plan, adapted, to be fair, but this is what Vote Leave says the UK could do something pretty similar based on the Australian system. Here's how it works in Australia. Applicants have to be under 50. I know. Many of you switching off now. Under 50. Any applicants aged between 25 and 32 automatically start with 30 points. I think I didn't mention, you need 60 points. If you get 60 points when you apply to live and work in Australia, you get at least 60 points, unless there's something against you in particular, they will grant you that visa. Okay, so you need 60 points. If you apply and you're between 25 and 32, you automatically, by virtue of your age, get 30 points. If you're over 50, as I say, you can't even apply for this. Those aged between 45 and 49 start with 0 points. All applicants must demonstrate a basic competence in English, right? I suppose fair enough, even just to apply and maybe do an interview and fill out the form, you'd need some English. But they're only awarded points for that if their English language skills are deemed proficient or superior. Then you'll get some points added. The remaining points, in order to get the 60, are awarded for certain qualifications and employment histories, which have been gained either in Australia or overseas. Other factors including tertiary education, such as university or something similar, of course. Whether your partner fulfills certain requirements as well, that might get you some points as well. If you've got a doctorate from an institution recognised by Australia, the PhD or a DPhil, if it's Oxford, of course, then that's worth 20 points in itself. So if you're 28 years old and you've got a doctorate, that's you've already got 50 points. Not bad. You need another 10, of course. Prospective residents can also gain points if they've worked in Australia before or if they studied in certain parts of the country, particularly if they've studied, for some reason, in areas that have a low population growth. So they don't mind more immigrants coming in, economic migrants, bear in mind we're talking about, if they're in that area. And for some visa subclasses, special areas, you need to be either nominated by the government, maybe some national security issue there. An employer might need to nominate you, or a family member as well. And if you're not sponsored by an employer, then you have to be on an approved list. Goes into big details. That's at border.gov.au, which I tried to look at this morning. It's very long. And for each of those sections, they have a limit. For example, for this year, if you want to go and work as an auditor in Australia or a company secretary or a corporate treasurer, they had 1,000 places this year and they've all been taken up. So there's no space on this scheme for that. Industrial, mechanical and production engineers, they've been taken up as well. 1,788 spaces they have for that, and 1,000 other engineering professions as well. However, and just to conclude on this, if you're a school teacher, not primary school, but secondary or tertiary, if you're a school teacher, then there are plenty, thousands of places left, in fact, for this year. If you're a vet as well, they need vets, or a cartographer. So if you do maps, for example, you're good at maps, then and you want to go and live in Australia, then you're in with a good chance if you're under 50, it has to be said. John says, you will be surprised that I will probably vote Remain, as I think it's too risky for the EU. Tusk's speech, Donald Tusk, is now recognising this and is concerned at the upsurge of the far left and far right. Perhaps the EU will change and start by dismantling the tax haven of Luxembourg. We all talk of UK risk of exit, far greater risk for the European Union. The UK exports about 44% to the European Union. The Leave side and the Remain side will agree on that figure. Or more, but and on the other side, the 27 other countries between them, they export to the United Kingdom. I quoted last week a figure of 3%. I've heard, I think even David Cameron say it's 8%. Let's go with a higher level, if you like, but it's only 8%. So the question of who would be the greatest loser if trade were hampered, would it be the UK or the rest of the European Union? Perhaps that's one argument to say that, in fact, the UK would potentially be worse off. Richard says, Australia is a nation of immigrants. Okay. I suppose the UK is, in a way, is it not? It has been forever, unless you're Celt, I suppose. Okay. And Kate says she would likely have been excluded from the UK if Leave wins. I'm not quite sure who you're referring to there. Now, let's just hear in just a moment, we'll be speaking to Raoul Rappel and a little later on in the programme to Adam Austerfield, who, among other things, represents the British Chamber of Commerce here in Spain. The time is 12:28. Reminder for you, 952 78 4000 is our phone number, and you can post on our forum at talkradioeurope.com. Or on Twitter, you can use the hashtag Britain Decides.
Britain Decides. TRE's coverage of Britain's EU referendum is hosted by Stephen Ridson, with expert guests, speakers from both sides, and your comments. Join in the debate on our online forum at talkradioeurope.com.
It's just gone 12:31. We're live, of course, as always. I'm joined now by Raoul Ruparel, who's the co-director of the highly respected think tank Open Europe. They've remained neutral all the way throughout the referendum campaign. Raoul, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I understand you're in Brussels at the moment. Is that correct?
Yes, in Brussels, getting the lay of the land here and see how they're reacting to the referendum and all going on in the UK.
Okay, could you, now, I mentioned there that Open Europe has remained neutral all the way throughout the referendum campaign. Can you summarise for our listeners what the... It's a think tank. What is Open Europe about? What are you for?
Well, we've been working for the past decade basically to try and drive reform in Europe. We're in favour of the EU in the sense that we believe it has economic benefits, but we believe that the focus should be more on the economic side, on the trade side, rather than on the political side. So we've been working closely to try and enact that kind of reform over the past decades, and we work closely with the government in the renegotiation. But in the referendum itself, we're neutral, and so we're not advocating remain or leave, but I think we generally come from a free market perspective, so if we remain in, we'd be very keen to see the single market furthered and that enforced more, and if we do leave, then we'd be keen to see an open and liberal approach taken to leaving. So that means keeping fairly open immigration, striking free trade deals in other countries and taking a broadly liberal approach.
You mentioned there free trade and liberal approach. Just briefly, as it might be relevant, TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which may be signed next year if it goes ahead, if it's ratified, presumably then free market is one of your mantras. You're in favour of TTIP going ahead?
Yes, we are. I mean, I think we accept it's not perfect, and in an ideal world we would have multilateral trade deals and the Doha round would have succeeded, but that is not the way the world is at the moment, and I think that TTIP offers a good opportunity to strike a very large and comprehensive free trade agreement between two of the largest economies or trading blocks, and therefore possibly even set the agenda for global trade and maybe restart this more multilateral type of trade agenda. So we are very much in favour of TTIP, and we don't really see that it poses as much threat as some people have suggested to the NHS or to other public services, and that caveats are clear in the TTIP document to make sure that there are no impacts there. So generally we're in favour of it and having it as comprehensive as possible, and we'd be keen for it to be pushed through as quickly as possible, to be honest.
Now, one of the issues, just moving away from TTIP for now, because it's a whole hornet's nest, you might say, whether you're in favour of it or against, but one of the cornerstones of the European Union is not just the free market, the free movement of goods and services and capital, but of people. And immigration has increasingly topped the agenda as far as the debate is concerned. Presumably as well, your organization sees that is correct, that there should be complete freedom of movement of people within the European Union with no restrictions.
Well, I think what we see is we're generally in favour of immigration and free movement. We think that there are benefits from immigration, and on the whole, migrants tend to provide a net benefit, a net contribution to the economy. But we also have to be aware that we have very diverse welfare systems across the EU. The UK has a universalist system. Other countries have more contribution-based systems. And so having these different systems and having a single free movement does complicate things. So I do think maybe there is a need to nuance the free movement and allow to take account of these different welfare systems, and that's something that happened in the renegotiation to an extent, and something which there is growing demand for in other countries such as Germany, the Netherlands. And I think that if you look at all the other free movements, the free movement of capital and services in particular, they are very far from complete, and there are lots of exceptions there, and they take account of national nuances. And so I think maybe a bit more of a pragmatic approach sometimes in the free movement of people could be useful, and that's I think taking a very dogmatic and absolute approach to it has possibly helped lead to the concerns and helped further concerns, at least, that we see in the UK and that are being played upon in this referendum.
Okay, so I noticed you said there a pragmatic approach, which is an interesting term because it leaves open all sorts of possibilities. Pragmatic, are you thinking of something like maybe we can impose some, we being whichever country, but we're talking about the UK principally here, we can impose some sort of temporary restriction, and as being pragmatic, it was a good idea at the time. Now we look at all the tensions that immigration is causing. We're talking intra-European immigration here, so from principally poorer Eastern European countries, or perhaps some Southern European countries with unemployment levels such as they are at the moment, that we can maybe tweak it a bit and impose some restrictions. You can't necessarily go to the UK and claim benefits or in work or out of work benefits just as a British person can do unless a certain period of time has passed. Would you propose that?
Yeah, I think we actually were originally proposing the policy which was picked up by David Cameron's government in terms of limiting in-work benefits and out-of-work benefits for EU migrants. So we do think that is something that can help. And, you know, polling and evidence shows that people in the UK generally are quite concerned about immigration, but often the concern is based on fairness and the idea that people are making the right level of contribution to the economy and not just coming over here to take benefits. And I think while the data suggests there aren't huge amount of numbers of people who do that, the migrants do come over to take benefits, I think the perception is there, and therefore I think we need to introduce some policies to tackle that and make it clear that those that are coming over are making a positive net contribution to the economy and helping further the UK economy. So I do think that would be a positive step. There have been steps to that, as I said, in the renegotiation. There have been tightening up of the rules on out-of-work benefits and the need for people to come and have a job in the UK if they are EU migrants. But I think there are still further steps that can be done. And I think this, when you do have such disparate economies in terms of development, in terms of economic growth, having these nuances does help ease the flows and ease the pressure at certain times.
Okay. All right. So if I understand it right, in simple terms, one of the issues, and there was a little bit of a disagreement, let's say, a tug of war between Angela Merkel and David Cameron when he was doing the rounds a few months back, trying to negotiate these few points, the opt-outs for the UK and whatnot, is that it's not about the benefits that you receive, let's say in the UK, suppose unemployment benefit or the dole money or job seekers allowance, whatever they call it these days. I know there are nuances and differences there. It's not that it has to be the same as Spain or Germany or Romania or whatnot. It's just that whatever it is in each country, so for example, in Germany, it's more to do with your previous work experience, same with France, same with Spain as well. So you may get a higher amount, but it maybe doesn't last as long, and it depends how many years you've paid into the system, rather than the sort of, by virtue of existing in the UK, you can claim greater benefits. As I understand it, it's not about the amounts, it's just whatever each country decides to do for benefits, that has to apply to every single citizen. So if the UK were to say you need to fulfill some conditions for 2 years and then you can claim benefits, that would be acceptable as long as they impose that on the British population as well.
Exactly. So it's about treating your own citizens and EU citizens the same. It's not that everyone has to have the same system. It's that both sets of citizens should be treated the same. But obviously the issue is, and what we saw in the renegotiation to an extent and the policy we proposed, is that some of these policies blur the line between social security, welfare, but also employment policies, and particularly the in-works benefits policies that the UK has. The idea was that originally started out as a policy to try and promotes employment amongst unemployed UK nationals, and to help get our workforce back going again, and to help some young people in particular who had got stuck in unemployment back into work. So that was quite a targeted policy, but obviously under EU rules that has to be applied to both EU and UK citizens, and therefore I think the point was that actually some of these policies which blur the lines between employment policies and welfare policies may want to be more targeted on just UK nationals, and that should be allowed. And I think that was the point that the government was making. And there was eventually some leeway given on that.
These figures that came out last week from the Office of National Statistics, which said that it was 300, and off the top of my head, it was quite easy to remember, 333,000 net migrants to the UK. So the difference between those leaving and those arriving. And we're talking people staying a year or more. long-term migrants rather than, 6 months or students, holidaymakers, whatnot. 333,000 was the figure given by them. Neither side has really disputed these figures, has to be said. Of those, 184,000 net migrants to the UK were EU citizens. Now, that leaves whatever the remainder is. It's less than half, but let's just say just under half of all those migrants to the UK last year were not EU citizens. How does that work? If it's such a problem with migrants, and even David Cameron on the Remain side has said in the past, we're going to control it and keep it down, and it's going to be in the tens of thousands and whatnot. Well, that may be difficult with a Romanian, a Bulgarian, a Spanish citizen, German, whatnot. But those Remainers, those are nearly half that are not from the EU. How come, if immigration is such an issue, how come they've been allowed to settle in the UK?
Well, I think this is an important point. I mean, it highlights that, the reason these people are coming is often for work because they have skills that our economy needs, and there are a number of industries that are reporting skill shortages, and, we have a point system for those from non-EU countries, but if they meet the point system and they meet a demand, then they are able to come. You also see people coming to study and a lot of people coming for family reunification. So these sorts of issues are going to be there whether we're in the EU or not, and you're right, there is a lot of non-EU migration already. And it's not clear, whether that is, it would be any different if the UK was outside or if it had a different immigration policy. And I think it highlights that these flows are global flows. A lot of it is based on the fact we have a strong economy, that we have a large immigrant population already, and that we have, low unemployment, record employment levels, and there is a big demand for certain skills, both high-skilled and low-skilled in the UK economy.
Okay, so in a way, maybe it's not identical to the Australian system, but the point system, we've been hearing very much about it over the last 24 hours from the Leave side. There's 60 points that are required. I explained to the listeners just a bit earlier exactly how that works in Australia. Presumably then those non-EU citizens that have arrived in the UK over the last year, the long-term ones, presumably they would all pass the point system.
Yes, well, I mean, some of them that come under, to study is a slightly different system, and those who have rights through family reunification is slightly different. But, those that are coming to work and look for jobs, they are subject to a point system, and a very stringent one at the moment, because they are trying to reduce that level of non-EU migration and hit the migration target of below 100,000. So, but they are, there is still a basic demand there and an economic need that the people are filling. So, they are subject to those points, but often they do meet them, and therefore they are allowed.
All right, well, that's it. Okay, it's interesting if that's the case. That's interesting that the non-EU ones, they're all, not all doctors and dentists and whatever, but all the skills that we need in society. Just a brief question, Raoul. I'm just watching the clock here, and we've got another guest to bring in. Could you just briefly, it's a big one for a little quick answer, but we hear about the Norwegian model. There's the Swiss and the Icelandic and Liechtenstein and whatnot, but for Norway, for example, Norway, one of the things we know, everybody agrees on this, that part of the deal struck with the European Union is they have to be part of this free movement of people issue. If we had a Norwegian model and similar, and we had that aspect of it in order to have the trade advantages that Norway has with the EU, what does that actually mean? Is it absolutely the same? In other words, if I or you, we go to Norway, we have exactly the same rights as if we were to go to Germany, for example?
Yes, I mean, it is essentially the same. They are part of the free movement of people. Again, the basic mantra that we discussed earlier is you have to treat your citizens the same as EU citizens. So that would still apply, and we'd have to treat, we have to treat citizens from Norway the same as EU citizens, and they have to treat us the same. And that would basically essentially be the same if we took a Norwegian model. There is, some way to raise disputes, but, it's not a veto, and it's not something that can be enforced strongly. It's just a mechanism in the Norwegian agreement where you can raise issues for discussion. But if you halted free movement under a Norwegian model, then you would also lose access to the market in return.
Right, okay, so you can't have one without the other. You can't have your cake and eat it. Raoul Raparel from Open Europe, your co-director of that think tank in Brussels, speaking to us live on Talk Radio Europe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Britain Designs. You're listening to Britain Decides, the EU referendum debate on TRE.
Welcome 12:48 is the time. We're trying to get Adam Osterfield, it's A-U, you see the way it's written. Adam Osterfield on the line. He's based in Madrid and he represents the British Chamber of Commerce here in Spain. You're not all retired. Many of you are living and working in Spain, whether you're working for somebody else or you're self-employed. You've got a little business or a big business, but of course, many people are self-employed. Looks on paper like a business, but it's just you. You're a plumber and a hardworking grafter. You're an autónomo in Spain, and the implications of that, what would they be if the UK were to leave? That's one of the questions I'd like to ask Adam. Rob is trying to get him on the line at the moment. We did speak to him earlier, but in the meantime, let's have a look at just a couple of comments on our forum. Christopher Kike, or Cake, from Calpe on the Costa Blanca. Good afternoon to you. Says, trying to hoodwink the younger generation into believing it will be beneficial to them in the future. They will positively regret voting to stay in. If common sense doesn't prevail, stay out and survive. Stay in and suffer financial hardship never imagined, says there. Another couple from Christopher. Pauline says, leaving the EU does not mean the UK could then ignore the European human rights regulations. What has that to do with in or out? If anything, the UK is leader in adhering to this. Ask Cherie Blair. She's made a lot of dosh defending these rights. The wife of former Prime Minister Tony Blair, she is a human rights lawyer. Among other things, and yes, she works in that field. Just briefly, of course, the European Convention on Human Rights is independent of the European Union. We're signed up to that. Theresa May, the Home Secretary, had suggested we could stay in the European Union and leave that. Problem with that is it's one of the conditions for membership of the European Union. We have Adam Osterfield on the line. Adam is he's the vice president, in fact, of the British Chamber of Commerce in Spain. He's also director of global market development at LSE Enterprise. That's the London School of Economics. Afternoon, Adam.
Afternoon. Good to be back.
Thank you. Pleasure to have you. Adam, there's one question I wanted to ask you in the business point of view. I mentioned before that our listeners, if they're working, they've got a business or whatnot in Spain. Let's just suppose, in one case, they're importing or exporting services. Let's start with, say, with the UK issue. One thing said by the Vote Leave side, maybe there isn't consensus on this, is that at the very least we could have WTO rules, World Trade Organization. In other words, before we managed to negotiate a special trade deal with the European Union, at the very least we'd have those WTO rules. Can you tell us what they are? Briefly, if we're importing something, say, from China or the United States or Morocco, for example, what do we charge them? How does that work? What do we charge them as opposed to goods coming from Germany? There's no charge, clearly, if they're coming to Spain. What do we charge non-EU members or non-EEA members?
It depends. It still depends on which country it's coming from. In the WTO, you know, we've already been members for many years. I think it's a very useful and one of the few sort of democratic institutions, although some countries have more power than others. So it really depends where your goods are coming from. I think more than the tariff point, which is an important one, but it will depend on your markets, is that there's a huge amount of norms and agreements within the WTO system that mean ways in which trade is transacted and protected is something that is taken under serious consideration. So they would be... there would be that as a backup, I think, but it would not in any way improve the transaction or neutralize the transaction costs that the European Union has done for intra-EU trade. So I think all of those things, if you think not only about what it would cost, but how to do business with a Chinese entity compared to a European one is a hugely different operation, where the legal basis for your deal is done, what currency exchange, all those kind of protections that the WTO helps to provide are not nearly as advanced as the European one. So it's still a very different system.
Right. Okay. And I suppose, I mean, we know recently the case of steel, where sure, where there's a higher tariff to try and counter that Chinese subsidies of their own homegrown steel, and there are different types of steel that have different different rates. So okay, there isn't a flat rate for everything.
No,
again, I keep
Yeah, you were going to say?
No, I was just going to say, I think one of the points from this is from our membership of the British Chambers of Commerce, where we're very strongly, our members surveyed 97% in favour of staying in, is that negotiating with huge economies like the US or China as an EU member makes a huge difference to be able to do business with them. So as you were mentioning earlier in the programme, a TTIP agreement might improve trade relations between those two entities in the same way in which bilateral trade deals, but much better done EU to China rather than Britain-China, would make a much better difference to people's businesses. So it's a big issue.
As I mentioned before, you're based in Madrid. What are the specific things, when you speak to people with businesses in Spain, expats in Spain, what are their concerns? Clearly, I would like to try and get just a bit ahead of the uncertainty factor, because clearly it was something we've never done before. Well, clearly there's uncertainty. But what are the concerns that they have principally?
Sure. Well, I think from the Chamber's point of view, we have a big operation in Andalusia, actually, run by our man down there, Derek Langley. And so there are a lot of SMEs down there. There's some other big companies, mainly in Madrid, they're sort of multinationals. In Barcelona, sort of a bit of a mix. But the message tends to be very similar. I think most people have a great deal of fatigue having come through a very, very difficult financial crisis here in Spain. Certainly the second worst in Europe after Greece. So just as people are getting back on their feet again, certainly in the British expat and business community, they're faced with another very major uncertain question about their future, that they're not sure, no one knows exactly what the outcomes will be, but certainly they know it will be uncertain. And I think that's finding the companies that we work with in our network, they're finding that very, very difficult, and probably most difficult at the SME level, because if you've been able to survive, the last sort of 6 or 7 years, now, and if you have connections in the UK, you have staff in the UK, you're employing people in Spain, you have strong UK connections or suppliers and so on, that looks like it's going to be even more difficult. And people also talk to us a lot about transaction costs, the difficulties of getting things done, which I think most people appreciate is hard enough in Spain as a quite a bureaucratic country. You have to set up your small business, you have to have a gestor, you have to set up your employment or social security. It's not one of the easiest countries to do that. Now, if we're non-EU member or nationals, that's going to become even more difficult. So if you're going to take on a new member of staff or bring someone in from the UK, those kind of things, getting things done is going to be increasingly difficult. And I think people increasingly tell us about that.
Okay. Well, obviously, we've still got 3 weeks to go until then. And either way, one of the things that they seem to agree on is that there is a good chance that whatever happens, that people are already in Spain and registered in Spain, then people aren't going to be booted out en masse. They seem to agree on that point.
Well, I think one of the major points that I think everyone can agree on is that whatever happens, it will take a long time for a lot of these different agreements to be unravelled between the UK and Europe. It'll be a big impact, a big splash, but it will take many, many years for all the new deals to be done and the old deals to be unravelled and agreed in a different way. So I think it's a question of not panic, but at the same time, the changes will happen and they'll come relatively slowly, but they'll be long-term implemented.
Adam, the clock is thrashing us once again.
Sure.
Thanks so much for joining us. Adam Osterfeld, Regional Vice President of the British Chamber of Commerce in Spain. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'll be back tomorrow at 12 o'clock with Europe Today. Until then, have a lovely afternoon. Bye-bye.